He's a native of New York City and received his early education there. Then he went on to do his work at Princeton Theological Seminary and at Johns Hopkins. He received his PhD from Johns Hopkins, where he worked under Albright. Then he began teaching following his ordination into the ministry of the Presbyterian Church. He's an ordained Presbyterian pastor. He taught at Johns Hopkins, then at two seminaries in Pittsburgh, at Western Theological Seminary and at Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He went on then to San Francisco Theological Seminary and served there, and also at the Graduate Theological Union there. Since 1971, he has served at the University of Michigan, where he is active as professor of biblical studies and director of the program on studies in religion. Dr. Friedman has received a large number of honors. He was a Guggenheim Fellow from 1958 until 1959. He served as editor of the Journal of Biblical Literature from 1955 until 1959. He is presently serving as co-editor and editor of the Anchor Bible Series. He has served in that capacity since 1956. From 1969-70 and again in 1976-77, he was the annual director of the Albright Institute of Archaeological Research in Jerusalem. He has served as a vice president of the ASOR since 1970, and since 1974 has served as their director of publications. He was president of ASOR in the 1975-76 year, and then he has served as editor of the Biblical Archaeologist from 1976 on. So we're very happy to have Dr. Friedman with us. He's going to tell us something about the Ebla tablets and the patriarchal period in Israel. I know that you're in for a real treat. I know that because I had the privilege of hearing him yesterday. Dr. Friedman.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here. This is already a familiar place to me now. It took me a couple of days to thread my way around, but I remembered that I was here about 20 years ago when there was a meeting of the Society of Biblical Literature. I didn't remember much about the meeting or the place, but now it all comes back to me, and I want you to know that I'm very happy to be here. I've enjoyed my stay. And having given this speech a trial run yesterday, the theory is it's going to be better today. Well, we'll see. I'm a little discouraged about the slides. probably today they'll work all right, but there's a lot of light out there. The slides are no good to begin with. I can promise you that because I took them. But they'll be worse in the sunlight, so we'll try them, and the easiest way to solve that problem is run them through faster, that's all. Now, the proposal is to speak until about noon. It's noon my time. 11 o'clock. Your time. And then allow some time for questions or discussion. I don't know whether there's possibility of more informal conversation later, but it doesn't matter. I'm glad to tell you anything I know. This particular discovery has a unique distinction, and that is we seem to know a lot more about all these things right away, and as the years have gone by and the studying has gone on, we seem to know less and less. And at the rate we're going, we might as well put the tablets back in the earth and forget about the whole thing. I may add that this is the first experience of the kind I've ever had, but then when you're dealing, on the one hand, with two Italians, and on the other hand, with the Syrians, you really never know what to expect. It's not coming through. Well, it may never come through. I have found over the years that no matter what kind of equipment one uses, it never works when you need it to work. So I don't count on very much. I hope you can hear me back there. I would normally say, if you can't, come forward if you want to, but in this case, that's not feasible. There are a few empty seats up front, but you may find it better back there. It's easier to tune out. We used to say the Presbyterians always filled rooms from the back forward, and no matter who came, they always left the front seats open. But that seems to be characteristic of you guys too. Well, now this is basically an endless subject. A lot of things have appeared in print so far, and there is considerable confusion about the subject. I would like to assume that all of you know something about it, but I'm afraid that that may not be the case, and some slight review may be useful as well. And I will say a few words to begin with, then I'll show you the slides, and then I'll say a few more words after we're done with them. And I'd like to open up several areas and then allow you to pursue whatever you feel you'd like to know more about. First, about the discovery itself. The major discovery of tablets, that's what we're talking about, was made on October 1st, 1975. This is a rare circumstance when you actually know what happened, when it happened, and where it happened. As you all know, most major archaeological discoveries are not made by archaeologists. In fact, there is an inverse proportion that the greater the experience, skill, and training, the less likelihood there is of discovering anything. And the greatest discoveries of all are not only made by non-archaeologists, but occasionally by non-humans. The Dead Sea Scrolls were in fact discovered by a goat. And remarkably, without a PhD. There may be some kind of lesson or message in this, but being both an archaeologist and having a PhD, I would rather not explore the implications too far. But the tablets were discovered under controlled conditions in an archaeological expedition in the early Bronze Age levels of an excavation at Tel Mardikh, which is the modern name of the ancient city of Ebla. What makes this discovery important? Well, there are three factors that make this an unusually sensational discovery. All discoveries are sensational, but this is even more so. This belongs in the category of perhaps the half dozen most important discoveries of our century. That's saying a lot. But I think that ultimately the confidence and its importance will be borne out, an importance that refers in the first place to the ancient Near East generally, and in the second place to the western part, that is the Syro-Phoenician-Palestinian area, and thirdly, in connection with the Bible. I think it's safe to say, in spite of all the controversy and the fact that hard, sure data and findings are still to be sought, that final decisions about the material cannot yet be made because of the peculiar nature of the writing system, the intricacies of which have challenged and baffled people for a long time. The cuneiform system of writing is essentially a very difficult, probably the most difficult one ever devised, more difficult than any system now being used in the world. And the trouble, the basic trouble, is that until you can work out the particular system used, that is, the equivalences and values, especially syllabic values, there is always an area of uncertainty. And given the fact that each of these signs is multivalent, that is, each cuneiform sign can have a number of different phonetic or syllabic values. That means that when you analyze a word of three or more signs, or two signs, whatever, there are different possibilities, and theoretically, there is no way to determine which is preferable. So one scholar will come out with one reading, another scholar with a different reading, and you can't say definitively, this is right, this is wrong. Both may be wrong, both are potentially right because of the way the signs are used. Ultimately, after enough trial and error and its inner coherence that finally makes the that allows one to make a decision, that takes time, that takes years. Fortunately, there are enough tablets to make it altogether probable, almost certain, that this problem will be solved and that finally people will agree. That's the most you can expect. External confirmation isn't feasible in a case like this because of the special features of these tablets. But ultimately, things will settle down and a lot of proposed readings will be eliminated and there will remain a certain corpus, a core of material on which there will be universal agreement. And from that, then, the meaning, the content, and all the ramifications can be worked out. Well, what are these three things? Number one, the quantity. Several thousand tablets and fragments are involved. The exact number is indeterminate because only those tablets and fragments which have writing on them and connected writing are significant. So the total number, which has been published in many places, 16,000, 17,000, is a little misleading. There are not that many readable tablets. Maybe 4,000 or 5,000 and a few more fragments, and then the rest are just little chips and slivers which only count in terms of the inventory, not in terms of reading. But even if it's 4,000 or 5,000 real tablets, that's a lot. Quite enough, more than enough to resolve most of the basic questions. And it also means that there's a vast amount of information. The tablets mostly, and this is true across the board, all the hundreds of thousands of tablets that have been found in the ancient Near East over a period of more than 3,000 years, most of them, from the beginning to the end, are commercial documents. That is, receipts, bills of sale, lists of transactions. In other words, writing, no doubt originated as part of a business operation. Literature, as we all know, is originally oral, and the idea of wasting valuable tablets to write literature on is only a later development. Business was the first requirement, and here it wasn't so much that you needed a record to remember things. You needed a record in order to establish the truth. Businessmen historically don't necessarily trust each other. So not only must you have it in writing, you must have it in duplicate. Xeroxing is only the latest wrinkle on a process that goes back to the very beginning. So we can say, on the basis of what we know of the Ebla tablets already, the thousands of Ebla tablets themselves represent a much larger number of tablets scattered all over the ancient Near East, because for every tablet at Ebla, every business tablet describing a transaction with some other urban center, there must be a corresponding tablet at that center. And since many of these tablets, including the one I brought with me, list a number of transactions, this little tablet I have has 15 transactions in grain, and there are 15 different centers with which Ebla was trading. Well, each of those centers must have had a corresponding record, not only of its transactions with Ebla, but with all the other cities around. And according to the latest estimate, there are at least 5,000 different places mentioned in the Ebla tablets. Well, even if 4,000 of them were just wide places in the road, it gives you an idea of the complex civilization in the middle of the third millennium B.C., So writing had already proliferated to the point where tablets were everywhere. So the quantity here, we could speak more about that. The tablets, if you just had a few, the first year, 1974, they found 42 tablets. That's fortuitous, and you get what the 42 tablets tell you. But if you have several thousand tablets, covering a period of perhaps 80 to 100 years in the sequence of kings, then you can begin to construct a kind of political, socioeconomic history of the place on the basis of the records. This is what social and economic historians would give a great deal for. And as you know, the most productive research now in the Middle Ages, for example, in Europe or colonial America, is based upon local records. Well, here are local records that go back to the third millennium, and it should be possible in the long run to reconstruct the essentials of this society in terms of its daily existence, its gross national product, levels of employment, things that would be beyond reach without this kind of collection. These are things that we still cannot do for biblical history, precisely because local records have never been found, or only found one or two at a time. Here are thousands, so that they can be put together to form a great mosaic. So quantity is extremely important, and this ranks with the major discoveries of tablets, like those at Mari and Nuzi, the Ashurbanipal Library, the Ugaritic tablets, and for Ugaritic itself, there may be a total of 2,000, quite a bit fewer than Ebla. Well, the second thing is the date. This is very early. This is on the fringe. If you go much earlier, you still have cuneiform tablets, and they are almost entirely unreadable because there's no framework in which to interpret them. So we're at the early edge of cuneiform writing, and of course, the earlier you are, the more unusual, and in general, the more difficult and the more important. So the date of these tablets is extremely significant. In the second millennium, there's a great deal of material. The first millennium, even more material. For the third millennium, there's comparatively little, and as you push back into the middle of that millennium, you're practically alone. These tablets correspond in their shape and the way in which the characters, the the signs are made, with several hundred tablets found at Abu Salabik, which is the other end of Mesopotamia, the eastern end. And then there's another collection from Farah, ancient Shurupak. And finally, there are tablets at Mari, which belong to the third millennium, the great collection, the 20,000 or so that were found back in the 30s. come from the second millennium, not of direct concern to us now. But there are several hundred tablets from the third millennium at Mari. And since Mari, this great center on the Euphrates, is mentioned in the Ebla tablets, it is possible now that a correlation can be established between the Ebla tablets mentioning Mari and the Mari tablets, which have not hitherto been read successfully, but now perhaps that will be possible. So there are only a relatively small number of tablets, and the Ebla find now outnumbers all the rest from this period put together. So that should put the Ebla discoveries in some perspective. And the third very significant element, and also one which makes things more difficult, is the location. Ebla, as you know, is far to the west, much further west than most cuneiform documentation. It's in western Syria, not very far from Ugarit. Ugarit is on the coast. Ebla is about 60 miles due east of Ugarit. And, according at least to Petinato and perhaps others, Ugarit is mentioned in the Ebla tablets. But, of course, this is an Ugarit which is 1,000 years earlier than the city of the Ugaritic tablets, with which I assume you all have some familiarity. And it is perhaps an indication of the problems that still confront the experts with regard to Ebla, that the Ugaritic tablets, which were first discovered in 1929, and the first studies appeared in 30 and 31, some of the problems were quite easy. As you know, Ugaritic is written in an alphabet. It's in cuneiform, but it's an alphabet of about 28 different letters. It's quite similar to our own alphabet. And it's much easier to work with an alphabet of 26 or 28 letters than with a cuneiform system of signs where you can have several hundred or even several thousand. And the further back you go, of course, the more signs. So Ugaritic had an alphabet which was very quickly deciphered. The language also was quite clearly a Semitic language, probably West Semitic, but that's a debate that is still going on. And it was in the middle of the second millennium, in fact, the second half of the second millennium, a period about which we know a lot more, and the language was clearly related to known languages of that period, the Canaanite, for example, of the Amarna tablets, which had been discovered even earlier. So all the local circumstances were favorable to the decipherment and the analysis and interpretation of Ugaritic, and still, 50 years later, and with some of the best minds in our field devoted to the study of Ugaritic, it is variously estimated that we can translate with some confidence perhaps half of the material. And the rest still remains problematic and very puzzling. Now, there are a lot of exceptional features to be considered here. These are not, for the most part, business documents at all, and the most important of them, of course, are the great epics or the great Ugaritic poems about the gods and so on, all of which make things more difficult rather than less difficult. But even so, what we can expect from Ebla is probably something similar, that 50 years hence there will still be a lot of problems and much of the material will remain obscure. This is not unusual. There are hundreds of thousands of tablets scattered around among the museums of the world, and by no means have all of them been deciphered and interpreted, and still fewer of them have been published. So when we combine quantity with date and with place, then we have a unique combination here, the middle of the third millennium, the western fringe of the Sumero-Semitic, we use the more general term because the debate has started and is still raging as to whether the Semitic language at Ebla, because the signs, of course, derive from Sumerian, and anybody who uses cuneiform signs has to know some Sumerian, and the so-called school texts, the tablets which the scribes themselves used, include bilingual dictionaries or glossaries so that they could move back and forth between Sumerian and the Semitic language, which no doubt was the language, the actual language of the people of Ebla, and which the scribes themselves would be more at home in. But the nature of this Semitic language is under dispute, and probably that will remain disputed, just as Ugaritic is still a disputed language until maybe for a long time. The debate is whether this is really Old Akkadian, that is East Semitic, but with Western components, that is a Western form of East Semitic, or whether it is really a form of Canaanite or West Semitic, but with Eastern elements. So the choice is Eastern form of West Semitic or a Western form of East Semitic, and there are scholars who think it's really somewhere in between. Happily, this does not make a great deal of difference, although it makes some difference, because remember, at the same time that they are trying to identify the language, they're also trying to decide the syllabic values of the signs. And depending upon how you feel about the language, you will assign values which support your view that it's East Semitic or vice versa. And the results then, of course, will tend to diverge. This seems like circular reasoning, and in a sense it is. But there is no real choice. And finally, the one that comes up with a more coherent system is going to win out. Well, perhaps now we will turn to the slides. I'll turn this off too. I'm not surprised that it doesn't work, but here we go. Well, I made a mistake. There we are. Well, if you can make it out, that is a map, a bad one, of Syria. And Lebanon down the lower left corner, and the sea is on the left. But if you look closely, and maybe it isn't too visible, down towards the lower left corner is Damascus, the capital of Syria. And if you go in a slight diagonal to the northeast, but up the map, there's another place, Aleppo. And that's the second city of Syria. There is a highway, really the major north-south highway of Syria. And Tel Mardik, which is the site, is between Aleppo and Hama. By the way, all of these places existed in the third millennium. And the same general distribution is to be found, including Damascus and Homs and Hama and Aleppo. All of them were in existence. And if you go straight across from Tel Mardik to a place called Latakia, that is just about where Ugarit is. Okay. Now this is the modern village of Tel Mardik with the so-called beehive houses. And these are also found at Haran, which, as you know, is where the patriarchs settled for a long time. And it's in this little village that the headquarters, the expedition, were located. The mound is right next to it. Here are the two principals. The man on your left is Petinato, who is the Sumerologist. He's the one who reads the tablets. The one on the right is Mattie. He is the director of the expedition. They are colleagues at the University of Rome in the Department of Near Eastern Studies. For many years, Mattie was the director. And you want to note that Petinato had nothing to do with the original expedition. It started in 1964, and Mattie dug there for 10 seasons, finding the usual kinds of things, but not attracting any attention. Then in 1974, in the 11th season, he discovered 42 tablets, and invited Petinato to study them because Mattie is really an art historian and not at all a linguist. And Petinato studied the 42 tablets and reported that, in his opinion, they were something quite unique. And the next year they found these 14,000 tablets in a single archive. And of course the word got out and everybody in the world wanted to know about the tablets. And of course Mattier was sort of brushed aside and Pettinato got all the attention. And given the fact that it was Mattier who spent all those years looking for them and finding them, and he was the director in addition, and invited Pettinato, the fact that they didn't get along to begin with, this only made things worse. So that is, in brief, the history. This is Mattier's wife, who is also, she's an Egyptologist and has been working on the dig as well. Well, the net result was, after a lot of unpleasantnesses, Mattier got Pettinato fired. First, he was prevented from coming back to Syria, and then, second, he was thrown off the dig entirely and is no longer the official epigrapher or decipherer. Well, that's a story, too. This is the mound. On the left, in the center, is the road that goes from Aleppo to Damascus. On the right, you see what looks like a low hill. That is the mound, which covers approximately 140 acres inside the walls. Those are the so-called beaten earth rampart walls of the Middle Bronze Age city. There are two main periods of occupation, an early Bronze Age occupation that runs through most of the millennium, probably from about 2800 down to 2200, and then there's a Middle Bronze Age occupation that runs from approximately 2000 to 1600. And what you see mostly is the second occupation, but it's the first one, the earlier one, that involves the tablets. Here is a sketch of the city, and as you see, it is organized in quadrants and quarters, literally, just as we use the expression, for a quarter of the city. And you see at the center is the Acropolis, like the Acropolis at Athens. This is on high ground, and where the principal public buildings were, and that palace called G on the map, that's where the tablets were found. And this is what it looks like. This is the entryway into one of the gates. And this also is Middle Bronze Age period. Here's a view of the upper city, the Acropolis, from the gateway. Let's get an idea of the vast expanse of the city, which may have had a population of 40 or 50,000 inside the walls. That would be enormous by ancient standards. According to Pettinato, one of the tablets says that the total population of the city-state, including its outlying districts, 260,000, which would compare favorably with a middle-sized city in our country today. And this is more or less typical of what you see when you visit an excavation in the Near East. It's not really as exciting as Greek or Roman digging. Here you can see the bare outline or floor plan of a public building, which may have been a temple or a palace or something like that. More of the same. Here you see one of the few artifacts that survives intact. This is a basin or a laver, and these are mentioned, of course, in the Bible in connection with the temple and various rites, ceremonies. Just what this, what was served, what purpose this served, is not clear. But here's a great ceremonial staircase from, again, the Middle Bronze Age period. And this leads up to the top of the Acropolis where a temple, this is the temple area, on top of the mound, the very highest point, and presumably the chief god of Ebla. And this chief god is known. His name is Dagon, and he's the same god, or the same name at least, as the god of Ashdod, mentioned in the Bible in connection with the Philistines. Dagon is also mentioned in the Ugaritic tablets. So this is a fixture in West Semitic religion. It is Pettinato's contention, at any rate, that these people are Western Semites, that their religion, their culture, is essentially of a West Semitic character. Here are some of the installations. Wherever you see carved or hewn stone, you know you're in the presence of an elaborate structure. Normally, they built with brick. This is not one of the ancient artifacts. But one of the people working on the dig, she was the only one who had good command of English, so she served as interpreter for me. And here you can see the edge of one of the squares. Typically, we all dig the same way. That is 5-meter squares with a 1-meter catwalk or balk, the purpose of which is not only to protect people from falling, but also to provide a vertical section. As you dig down, it's not easy to tell the strata, but you can check this against the vertical section, which is an obligatory part of digging. Here you see Metier down at the Early Bronze Age level, where the great discoveries were made. Here is a view of the gateway way off in the distance from the top of the mound. And here you can see the brick-like material which was used for most of the building. And this is a tumbled wall connected with the Great Palace. Let's see more of this. This is the facade of the palace with the plaster still partly in place. This wall stood to a height of 3 or 3.5 meters, so it's quite elaborate. This is a great palace, maybe 50 or 60 rooms, with a huge courtyard in front of it. And here you can see evidence for the burning of the palace. Some dispute about this, but Metier thinks this is the destruction of Ebla by Naram Sin around 2200 BC. He was the grandson of the great Sargon, Sargon the Great of Akkad. And here in the courtyard you see this platform, which was used perhaps by the king or his representative to receive delegations, whether diplomatic or commercial or both, to the palace. And it was in and around the courtyard that the goods were stored, and where the archive of these commercial transactions were recorded. So it's around this courtyard that we're going to see the there you can see the floor. And this room, rather nondescript, is nevertheless the center of attention. If you look very closely, you can see little post holes. Those supported shelving, and this was the archive room. You see the floor has subsided because there's an underground spring, but this room, when it was first uncovered, had thousands and thousands of tablets and fragments scattered all around. You can find these pictures in the Biblical Archaeologist or the new books that both Metier and Pettinato have just published. This was an extraordinary moment. That was October 1st, just before they were going to close up shop. That always happens, too. And the tablets had been stored on the shelves. And when the shelves collapsed, the wood just disintegrated, the tablets fell, but they fell so that they preserved the arrangement. Now, theoretically, at least, when you find something like that, you don't move anything until you have not only a pictorial record, but you tag everything in place, because the filing system, these tablets are quite thick. They're like photograph albums, and they were organized according to titles, summaries, little indicators on the edge. So it's a significant filing system. A number of librarians, when they first heard about this, wrote to me and asked me what the system was. And one thing has emerged, that is, there were three shelves, three levels. And on the top, they put the smallest tablets. In the middle, they put the middle-sized tablets. The bottom, they put the big ones. And if you go to the Hebrew University Library, the great new library in Jerusalem, they use exactly the same system. So
So any suspicion you have that the people who work in libraries are really illiterate, probably justified. That's what tablets look like. When I was over there, we were very careful not to take pictures of the actual tablets, and this is one I did not take. A friend took it on another occasion. In a way, I'm sorry I didn't take more, but in fact, you can't read from this. And quite a number have been published as pictures, but that gives you a little clue both to the variety. And, of course, there are hundreds of each kind here, ranging from very small, something that would fit in the palm of your hand, to these huge ones, which are about the same size as this lectern top. And on those, as many as 3,000 entries can be recorded, so you can list the transactions for a whole year or even a reign. And the size and shape have a lot to do with the content. This was all organized in a very systematic fashion. Well, that completes the slides. And I'll just say a few more words, this time about the patriarchs, because in the in the initial reports and subsequent reports, the tablets that record these transactions are the ones that are easiest to decipher and analyze because they have important clues. First of all, there are numbers which are known, and secondly, they only give commodities, values, quantities, and all of this is highly systematized so that it's easier to make them out. But these are the tablets that include a lot of place names, of course, of the cities involved in transactions, and personal names as well, whether of the merchants or of the kings of these places, they are mentioned too. So from the beginning, a rather sizable onomasticon, that is, list of names, has become available. Now, some of these names are, again, in dispute because of for the reasons I mentioned earlier, and that is you can read the same signs in different ways. And the assumption generally is that if you can make out, by using accepted values, a word or a name or a place that you know, that tends to support the view you've got it right. On the other hand, that's not necessarily the case, and people have been misled by this. Pettinato leans to the idea that a lot of the places that Ebla dealt with were south and west of Ebla, and not just east and southeast and north, which would include, of course, the whole Palestinian area. And I must say that some of the names are quite impressive, like Tanakh or Aqaba or Ashdod or Ekron. These are all mentioned in the tablets, according to Pettinato. Some of these names are disputed, and the opinion is held that most of the places mentioned are right in the vicinity of Ebla, or they are the great classic cities of Sumero-Akkadian civilization. Well, that will take some time to resolve.